Thank you very much for a wonderful, wonderful address. If anyone has any questions or comments they would like to make, yeah.
You touched on, I think, grace in her work, which is rarely commented on. Do you understand that? I mean, there's an invisibilization around a lot that she did, but I've often wondered why that, in particular, kind of dropped off the radar screen of people's reading of her. How do you understand it?
Well, a lot of women of color know it's there and haven't missed it at all. I think it's because it would give her credibility that pigeonholing her as just the woman who talks about women, as if racism isn't about women, that pigeonholing, confines her. People think that things about women are, that's just that stuff about women. Now let's talk about freedom or equality or dignity, but this about women is just that stuff. And it would break down that isolation to recognize the central place that it always had in her work and the indivisibility of the analysis of male dominance and white supremacy in her work.
Yes, you know that there's all kinds of lies out there about how feminists never considered issues of race, and the women's movement was a white women's movement, and so on and so on.
As if all these women of color weren't there making
absolutely.
The women's movement before
absolutely.
Day
but
one.
It's the most common attack on feminism, really. And then you go back and look at Woman Hating, which is from 1974. There's a huge section in there on race and how feminism came from the struggles against racism in the U.S. It's an enormously powerful section. Mm-hmm. The book was 1974, so it was written in the 2 years previous to that. So it gives the complete lie to these very serious and ridiculous accusations against feminism. So
but also against those accusations, which in part are valid for pointing out that an analysis of racism in the women's movement in general needs to be better, needs to be go further, and so on. It also makes invisible all the women of color who are the backbone of that movement. In other words, it has this double way of being racist in itself. It's like they weren't even there. Like they aren't even there. I'm sorry.
Well, one of the things you raised in your talk made me think of something that I've been thinking about her work a lot, which is where you said that many of her individual sentences could be PhD theses in themselves. You could
right.
take a sentence and unpack that and go more. Mm-hmm. And it's often I've often felt that Andrew Dworkin's work here is complex. It's very detailed. It's very nuanced. It's very kind of packed with meaning. And I think one of the reasons perhaps why her work has often been misrepresented is because people haven't been willing to read it with that kind of complexity and haven't been willing to read it with that kind of seriousness that often people are willing to read the work of great male theorists, so called. That they've kind of been willing to just read it very quickly and to see sentences which are hard to understand in the kind of nuanced way that they're meant. I wonder, would you share that idea?
I do. People were told how to read Andrea Dworkin's work and have remarkably, on the whole, it strikes me, as accepted that. They were told, simplistic lies about what it's about, and including about what our work together was about. And so that's then what they see, people who should know better. And especially people who make their living by reading and writing about what they read really should read what they write about.
I wondered if you could say anything helpful about way forward in the world. Look at the situation through Andrew Dworkin's vision of it. And, you're living it, and we're all living it in different ways. You're an academic, you're working in law, I'm an academic, I've got a family. We're all in these different situations. John was saying earlier, you know, we're put in these positions where we have to compromise. We don't have to compromise to people like Andrea.
Do you have tenure?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well.
Yeah, but I'm not gagging if I'm at university. I may not say the concept properly.
Pardon me?
I'm under a gagging order from my university, and I may not say why, but I'm in a kind of complicated position. But, you know, I'm constantly interacting with people who make my blood boil, and I'm sure there are lots of people here who are as well. And I don't know, I mean, I suppose there's no simple technique, but it seems to me this is always a privileged position where you either confront the challenge, and that's really hard and painful, and you pay a high price, or else you don't say anything and it makes you just that little bit crazier. And so you go on. And I just wondered, I don't know if this is the line too.
Well, I mean, this may sound odd, but I don't identify as an academic. I am, you know, I do work in the world, which includes when I can financially afford to do it, thinking and writing, which I myself did for 12 years with no job at all. And I mean, no real job, just one hitch to another kind of thing. You know, it's called unemployment in the academic world. And you know, and if the academic world finds value in it, looking on while I'm addressing the world as a whole, that's up to them. So that's what I have to say about that. I think, too, that the way academia works is that younger people think that they will sell out now just a little bit in order to get tenure so that then they can say something which is why they wanted to be in academia in the first place. And what happens is that process destroys in you the very possibility of becoming the person who will have anything to say by the time that time comes.
I just meant by, I didn't mean academia in any way special. I don't think it is. I just think it's one of many contexts in which women find themselves under pressure.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And I take your point that as quickly as you make the compromise, you kind of put out to reach the very thing you're compromising to obtain. But I just wonder what the hell you do, because I feel as though in the end you can just go crazy. You know, that vision of the world is so dark, you know, that she said she did the atrocity work, and the experience of it is so bad. You know, is there some sort of manoeuvre that we can make that doesn't mean doing battle with men and doing battle with people around us?
Well, I actually think it's kind of important to, and indeed, how to say, I think one gets a lot of self-respect out of having integrity, and that gives you a kind of energy. It isn't called doing battle with people around you all the time. It's called not letting every atrocity just go by you. I think a tremendous amount of women's energy in particular goes into denying atrocities to women. And I deal with them very directly, absolutely all the time. And, you know, people are always asking me, you know, how can you, like, do this? And I'm like, how can you, like, not? And I don't mean that as a moral stand. I mean that as a stand of how much of your energy is going into denying what's going on around you. How much of it is going into holding down, holding in, shutting up, squishing, compressing, flattening yourself inside yourself. You know, you get a tremendous amount of energy out of actually letting it in and flowing back with it, letting it go through you and feeling what it really feels like and being changed by it and knowing what you know and saying it and finding ways to say it and push back against it and work around it. And you get a tremendous amount of energy from actually. You know, Andrea once said to me, and it was like shocked me totally to death. I think she published it, that she, how'd she say, that she had recently come to think, in something she learned largely from me, she said, that women have a right to be effective. Now, I had never thought of it that way, you know, but you know, I think that we do, like we live here too, and that. Understanding that we have a right to occupy space and, you know, to speak out and to say what we see, and, you know, that that isn't the same thing as, quote, doing battle all the time, as if you're just, you know, smashing your head against a brick wall. It's actually engaging with the life of your own time, as opposed to acting like you weren't even there.
From Andrea that I attribute to.
Oh. No, that's right, Ian, yes, go ahead.
Am I?
Yes,
yes.
Okay. Sorry, what's behind you?
that I attribute to Andrea, and I probably mangled it a little bit, that's not repeated, and I wouldn't be able to know where to find it. Maybe you could help me with this. That she said that biological superiority is the world's
most dangerous idea.
Where is it?
It's in our blood somewhere. It's somewhere in our blood. I'm certain.
Yeah, and it's only said once, I think.
John, do you know where it is? It's someplace in our blood.
It might be online.
Look in Nikki's website. You know where Twitch knows where it is.
It's on
Nikki
Kraft's website.
The website is online.
Yeah, and as I say, ironically, I was the one who was asked, I think, for favorite quotes, and that was one that I thought.
About the delusion of sexual polarity and... Oh, no, right, the biological determinism being the world's most dangerous idea. Yeah, see now, sociobiologists.
Well, I don't want to put you on the spot, and this might be a topic for a conversation rather than a Q&A session, but I sense a lot of teachers, or people who teach here, and the one time Andrea taught was at the University of Minnesota, and she co-taught with you, and I don't know a lot about that time because she was in Minneapolis and I was in New York.
And she missed you very much.
Her question was,
I remember that.
What you learned while teaching together about teaching. I think that's my question. I just want to know.
Well, one really major thing we learned was that we thought that we could teach a course on pornography. And, of course, you can't teach on a subject that isn't there, you know. I mean, in other words, it'd be like teaching about a novel and not reading the novels. So, and indeed, sometimes it was novels. But in any case, the way we organized it was, the assignments were, here's the pornography and here's the law on this pornography, which is usually just so way whacked out beside the point, the second of the first. It was highly instructive. So here's the pornography, here's the law on the pornography, here's the pornography, here's the law on the pornography. And we went all the way through, Playboy to Snuff, you know, and everything in between. And what we learned is that that to say pornography violates women was not it was not excessive, and it was not a metaphor. That what was happening was that our students were in traumatic stress on a week-by-week basis. And indeed, a couple of them had psychotic breaks. One when she, due to just, we actually had child pornography, and that was assigned as well. And she, just in the way one of the children in the child pornography looked or turned or something, suddenly she remembered having been sexually abused on a stage when she was a child, and pornography, not too long before, and pornography had been made of her. Anyway, that was her. Like, there were five or six people who had extremely serious psychological consequences from this. And the whole class was this accumulation of traumatic stress over the term. And so we learned that you can't do what we thought you could do. And we learned how much, that's what we learned about teaching, was that you can't do this, you know, unless you want to violate your students. And pornography violating women was not hyperbole. And it was not an approximation. And this is before there had been any real studies on the effects on women of consuming pornography, but the men were as messed up and harmed by it as the women. There were lots of men in that class. And that's one thing we learned. That you can't ever assume that you control the context more than the pornography does. That the pornography is its own context. That's what we learned. You surround it by critique. You know, you surround it by law. You surround it by whatever. You know, but it is still going to do what it does. And it did it. Okay. We learned that. We also learned that from the people who snuck in, who weren't at the university, and just came in and sat in the back, and the people who were, that first of all, that some of them, and in particular, Andrea had always known this, but we both learned it all over again in a whole other way, that when people, first of all, that prostituted women know everything, and that when, that if and when their visions can be brought out and applied, that whatever it is you need to know is something that they already know. And there were numbers of them. And that there's something about the organizing potential of the issue of pornography in relation to prostitution that broke open in that class and has gone forward ever since. And we learned that about teaching as well, both, you know, in the university and in a university within a city. And it also turned out then eventually to be a lot of the people who were our students who became the organizers for the ordinance that she and I ended up writing out of the process of our teaching together. Just a couple things that occurred in the film.
I've been quite emotional. It's been an amazing day for me. Quite long. I'm a radical feminist. I just want to say that because it's a great thing to sit here today. I'm a radical feminist. I think some people may understand, and even the people who don't understand may be interested. I just want to say that. There's a lot of people here are too, but it is dark times, it's difficult times for women now, is my perception. And thinking about what we could do, not that I by any means have the answer. Thinking about muscles, you know, muscles lose their tone very quickly if you don't use them. If you become very weak, you can lose the use of them. But they respond very quickly to use, they build up very quickly. And one of the things I was to say was, why don't we all try to go out from here and just talk to people we encounter about what this day has meant to us, if it has. Then it'll all start happening then. It will start happening then because there's another world out there. And I perceive that there's, I feel there's a sort of support and light and everything else. Say, like you spoke a little about the light.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go on too much making a speech, but
thank you.
It's just really meant a lot to the person who I'm today.
Andrea wanted respect for her work, and this conference has that. So thank you.
There are no more questions, but because I'm a very good place in which to end, we do have a drinks reception in the common room, which you're all very, very welcome to come to, and I hope you will. But I'll just end by thanking you all for coming, and thanking again Catherine McKinnon for her wonderful